Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com and get up to 15% off your first purchase as a member with code REBAGNEW. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAGNEW for up to 15% off your first purchase as a member.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hey everybody, I'm Kim Holderness.
And I'm Ben Holderness, and you have found the Holderness Family Podcast. How you doing, Kim?
I'm doing great.
So this is an exciting and fun episode. I love bringing in interesting people, and Walt Hickey is incredibly interesting. The way that he thinks and views the world is very unique, and it has us all nodding our heads.
And you're going to come away from this podcast having such cool things to talk about at cocktail parties.
Yeah.
You know, we've been curious about how to start conversations. Man, will you have some ammo after listening to this podcast?
We'll get to him very shortly. Want to mention a couple of things. First of all, the last installment of our three-part series all about ADHD drops this Thursday, April 25th. We hope that you've enjoyed them as much as we've enjoyed making them. It has been part of the labor of love that includes getting our book into the world. And I can't believe I'm saying this right now, but Kim, our book is coming out 1 week from today.
If you're listening to this and the day it's released, it's coming out on April 30th. If you want to learn more, if you're not sick of us talking about it, go to ADHDisAwesomeBook.com. If you'd like to meet us and give us a big awkward hug, have us sign a book.
Yeah.
Meet in person. We're having events in New York City, Los Angeles, Raleigh, Charlotte, and Minneapolis in the month of May. So you can learn more at our website or in the show notes. It's all very exciting.
Yeah. Well, anyway, we have Walt Hickey on the podcast today. He is the author of You Are What You Watch, How Movies and TV Affect Everything. And we're super excited to talk to him about his book and his research, like about how what we watch shapes us and the world around us.
We are surrounded by media, and he's got such amazing insight about how it really changes us. And then after we talk to Walt, our producer Anne Marie will join us for some fun and games. We have some 90s movie trivia, in which I am terrible. I've been trying to be more aware of the content I'm consuming. I'm talking digital content, books, things on the big screen, because I am very aware that it changes me and it changes my mood. And then we started doing this research and found this book by Walt Hickey. Did you know, Penn, that after the Hunger Games, more people took up archery?
I feel like I was in a local newsroom and they had me go do a story on archery.
Yes.
Like literally I went out and people are like, well, no one's ever come here in about 18 years. And now look at all these people who want to be Katniss.
Yeah. So,
yeah.
And then after 101 Dalmatians, more people got Dalmatians. And more people became paleontologists after watching Jurassic Park. It's a whole, if you can see it, you can be it phenomenon, which is why representation is so important. Okay, funny story. We live in the state of North Carolina, which the New York Times calls, I think, the capital of basketball, because we have Duke, UNC, NC State. So we are in this bubble in which every house has a basketball hoop, and the soundtrack of all neighborhoods here is just the sound of basketballs bouncing. And it's typically, as I'm going running my errands and going to Target, I see all the boys out in the driveways. Let me tell you, after Caitlin Clark and friends have had this rise, it has been fascinating to see their sisters out in the driveway. I mean, I got goosebumps one day, just the entire street, it was nothing but girls outside. And because they saw it happen, they now know it's possible. So what we watch and what we consume really matters.
Yeah, I think so. The Caitlin Clark thing, I'm thrilled about that too. I remember like the sports phenomenons, it really does happen. There's always a bump in soccer after the World Cup. After the Olympics, there's all these sort of fringe sports that become more popular. But it is, to me, super interesting, the pop culture side of it. Because yes. I never really made that connection. I didn't realize until talking to and listening to Walt that I think that Seinfeld was one of the big reasons why we ended up like really wanted to move to New York. And that was like the city I wanted to be in for a long time. You know, I think so many things in movies, I've become so obsessed with like space and sci-fi. I think that's the main reason that I wanted to be an astronaut. And then I talked to an astronaut and they're like, dude,
this is really hard.
Like, first of all, do you have vertigo? Oh, you have vertigo? Oh, you're out.
You're out.
Like, you can't do that. Also, like, we just don't have gravity and it punishes your body for a long time. It's a good friend of mine who I actually have spoken to from the space station. Walt's going to talk about that as well.
Okay, let's get to it. Walt Hickey is a journalist and author. He is currently the executive editor for Sherwood News. In 2022, he won a Pulitzer Prize for illustrated reporting.
In spring of 2018, he launched his creator-owned daily morning newsletter, Numlock News. It's all about the cool numbers buried in the news. I love this. Also, it was sort of born from when he was working for 538.com, which is another one of my favorite kind of numbers data-based websites. But his newsletter is funny. It makes you smarter. He also serves as the president of the GALICA, the Society of LGBTQ Entertainment Critics. And he's the author of You Are What You Watch, How Movies and TV Affect Everything.
Welcome to the show, Walt.
Thank you so much for having me. This is a lot of fun.
So excited to talk to you. A huge fan of all of your content. You personally, there's a lot of you in this book. What are some of the realizations that you had about, you know, what you perceive from a movie, how it changed your perception of the world?
Yeah, that's a real good one. I had always really believed in the power of this stuff. I have a background in math, applied math, stats, things like that. I'm a data journalist by day. A lot of that job involves talking to folks and looking at numbers and looking at data and just kind of seeing, you know, hard representations of things in the world. I had always talked to a lot of folks who either worked around movies or just in various different jobs. And I was always kind of shocked how quickly someone would just be like, oh, yeah, like I'm a doctor because I watched Grey's Anatomy growing up or something like very quickly, like very people will volunteer the movie that changed their life and then just move on as if they didn't just reveal something incredibly personal and fascinating. And so, you know, when I was doing the book, I was always kind of taken aback by how excited folks were to finally talk about like, oh, yeah, like I saw Twister every week when I was a kid, and now I predict weather in Oklahoma City. And seeing that kind of direct conduit was so nice because it kind of gives you a sec to look at your own life. Ian Malcolm, mathematician in Jurassic Park, that kind of was pretty formative for me. That was like seeing an example of a guy who really could, make an impact on the world, correctly predicted what would happen in Jurassic Park. And you can kind of trace like, yeah, you know, I did really get into math after seeing that movie. And so I don't know. It's always such a breath of fresh air to get a chance to really take a step back and realize what these things mean to you.
I love this as a mom of two teenagers that adults who don't know how to make conversation with them will just say, oh, what do you want to be when you grow up? I'm 48 and I still don't know what I want to be when I grow up. But you kind of invented this area of research and study and made a job out of it because it became interesting. So I think it's just really cool. So no question, just that you're cool.
Here's my question. And that is, it's a good point. How many people that you've talked to were like disappointed? Like, wait, we can't have sex in the broom closet every 15 minutes if we're a doctor? Like it's, you know, like looking at Grey's Anatomy or, you know, paleontology is not like there's no actual dinosaur. Here.
I'm telling you, listen, on one hand, you got that for the Grey's Anatomy fans. On the other hand, every week, it's not like a doctor's exploding or something. So there's pros and cons of not being a Grey's Anatomy doctor,
true.
You know?
Yeah.
True.
But yeah, I mean, it is, you know, they are elevated versions of life. But I mean, you know, you mentioned paleontology, like that movie, Jurassic Park, those films in the 90s really did kickstart a ton of investment, a ton of interest, a ton of jobs, and a ton of research in vertebrate paleontology. You can see the spikes in papers published and funding allocated and in majors that were done there. It is really cool to watch, you know, some folks really get pushed into this.
How much of this happens when we're kids?
A lot.
Yeah.
A whole lot. Yeah. I will tell you guys, I think my favorite study from this book was essentially like I was very interested in like heroes and kind of what they mean, especially for kids, right? And why superhero play is very interesting. Kids pretending that they're Spider-Man, kids pretending that they're superheroes. And a lot of that comes down to these ideas of like power fantasies. And like power fantasies, I think, get kind of a bad name now, particularly on the internet, because you have, you know, oftentimes like adult male power fantasies and people, you know, indulging in those is complicated. But what that kind of gets away from is that power fantasies are really important for kids because kids don't have power, right? Like kids don't have autonomy. They have to do what they're told. They have a very finite list of options. And power fantasies are important because that's going to change one day. They're going to have power. They're going to become adults. They're going to have control over themselves and the ability to influence the world. And power fantasies, you know, pretending that you're Spider-Man, pretending that you're a cowboy, playing cops and robbers, whatever have you, those are important because they show values of what you should be doing or can be doing when you do get power. So that when they do grow up, they think of people, you know, like Superman, like Truth, Justice, American Way, or they think of folks like Spider-Man, where it's, you know, with great power comes great responsibility, and they can live those values even though they don't possess the power that underlies them at a young age. I think that we really underestimate how important some of this stuff can actually be when it comes to setting role models. And even just the idea of, you know, understanding that there's a person in the world who can do things and has character while doing them. I don't know. I find that really phenomenally interesting.
There could be an argument that violent films and content could inspire violence. What are your thoughts on that? And what should we be doing about that? Yeah.
It's a really good question because when you write a book about how pop culture affects the world, one of the most persistent conversations that we've had in our society, in our country, in the world as a whole, is what violence does on screen and what it provokes. And so an interesting element is that we know in a laboratory, right, if you show somebody violent imagery, if you show somebody violence, they get more agitated. They get basically the volume gets turned up a little bit in the brain. This is just, you know, this goes back. We're primates, folks. Like this just kind of happens. And so that response, you know, one would expect if you were to, you know, do that across an entire society could have, you know, negative ramifications, right? We know in a laboratory that humans get more agitated and react potentially more aggressively when they're agitated. So we ought to expect to see a fairly large reflection of that agitation in our society when we, for instance, release a slasher movie that is seen by a million people in a weekend. Mm-hmm. And these two economists out of California, Gordon Dahl and Stefano Della Vigna, wanted to look into that because they basically were just like, we should be able to measure this, right? What they found really surprised them, and I found really fascinating, which is that essentially not only do they not see evidence that there's more violent crimes, more assaults, more things like that on a given weekend when a violent film is in cinemas, they actually saw that it went down a little bit. And I think it's very interesting because, again, it did go down by a statistically significant amount. It is worth talking about. It essentially averts, you know, a few 10,000 assaults per year, essentially. And they tried to define this, and they came to a piece of wisdom that I kept coming back to during the book, which is it's not so much what you're doing. It's what you're doing instead. And so the idea is if I put a violent film in cinemas, sure, people are going to see it. They might get a little bit more agitated as a result. That's going to happen. But on an alternative night, on the night in which that didn't come out, perhaps the you know, the generation of you know, often young, often male viewers of violent cinema would instead, you know, be out and about
drinking.
Or more specifically, drinking.
Yeah.
And the one thing that you can do to really increase your risk and increase, you know, potentially violent behaviors is number one, getting drunk, and number two, getting really drunk. And by sequestering oneself in a cinema for 3 hours, number one, you're not getting drunk. And number two, even if you go out drinking after, you're not going to get as drunk as you would be if you were in for the duration of 3 hours, continue to drink as well. So it's a diversionary idea that even if there is this agitating effect, it is kind of drowned out by the fact that you're doing a rather innocent and clean live-in activity.
So two more things I want to touch on. Number one, you've done a lot of research on the effect that these movies, these films have on our society. What's the difference between the effect that movies have on our society and the effects that, let's say, the new age of media, the internet, social media has? I feel like they're two different things, right? One of them is one of them is idyllic, and one of them is a little more like these. I think people are feeling like they're actually developing relationships with people on the internet. Totally. But I'm wondering what the difference is in your research.
Gosh, I'm so happy that you asked this, because like one of the big things in the book was like, you know, you have to write a book. You can't have it be too long, right? I want to be a specific thing. So figuring out where the borders of this thing were a really interesting question. I didn't want to spend too much time doing stuff in the book about the new age of media. I wanted to kind of focus in on specifically this kind of narrative-based storytelling thing. But the fun thing is that a lot of the, you know, new era of media is really using a lot of the techniques of the traditional way of doing stuff. And so I'll give you, again, a personal example. I don't know how much you guys kind of watch this stuff, but one thing that's really exciting about the new age of media and specifically digital media is I think it allows more collisions and experimentation with genres that would not have been feasible outside within traditional Hollywood. And you see this every time you get a new piece of technology, actually. So when we invented cinema in the very beginning, you know, horror movies had to be invented, right? Because there's nothing quite like even like a horror novel, like the novel Dracula, is a fundamentally different type of thing than a horror film like Nosferatu, right? Because they're using different things. You can't really do a jump scare in a book. You can't really do a jump scare in even like a comic strip. And so new technology facilitates new discovery and new collisions between genres. It's a real growth time. You know, it's a real chance to kind of see what works and experiment and learn more new things about ways that we can communicate with each other and empathize with each other.
All right, so I want your next book either to be about that, or I want you to do an entire book and try to explain to me how my feelings about AI have been so heavily affected by The Matrix and iRobot and Battlestar Galactica, and I had don't trust it at all. I'm just awful. Like we had you
a BSG guy as well. I love BSG.
we had an AI expert on, and she was talking about all the benefits, and I get that, like educational benefits. I'm just terrified, and I guarantee you it's because of these movies that I've watched. We will be right back. Don't go anywhere.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Let's be honest. We've all had embarrassing BO moments. Like any time you have to speak in public, if you don't put deodorant on, it's like a different type of sweat. Ugh. And you and I did like a thing and I got done. And thank God I had a blazer on because it sort of masked it. But then I took it off and got in the car and it was just like...
There is a lot of pit sweat. Yeah. Fortunately, Lumi Whole Body Deodorant is making it so none of us ever have to worry about that BO again.
Unlike certain other DOs, Lumi is powered by mandelic acid to control odor in a new way.
Lumi delivers outrageous 72-hour odor control everywhere from your pits to your feet.
Lumi is a game-changing deodorant designed by an OBGYN.
Fast forward 6 years and her Whole Body DO has now earned over 300,000 five-star reviews.
How? Well, unlike certain traditional deodorants that try to mask odor with a fragrance, Lumi is formulated to stop odor before it starts. More like a pre-odorant.
I personally love that Lumi is baking soda free and paraben free.
You can choose from a variety of fresh, bright scents like clean tangerine, lavender sage, or toasted coconut.
Lumi's starter pack is perfect for new customers. It comes with a solid stick deodorant, cream tube deodorant, two free products of your choice like mini body wash or deodorant wipes, and free shipping.
As a special offer for listeners, new customers get $5 off a Lumi starter pack with code HOLDERNESS at LumiDeodorant.com.
That equates to over 40% off your starter pack when you visit Lumi Deodorant and use code HOLDERNESS.
And it's Lumi, L-U-M-E.
One reason that we can watch WALL-E, right, the film from Pixar, and empathize with WALL-E is that, you know, evolutionarily, there's this thing called anthropomorphism, which is that we attempt to empathize with anything that looks vaguely human. It's why dogs, cats have big old eyes, and we think that they, you know, we assign personality traits to them, we assign thoughts to them, we assign beliefs to them, regardless of whether or not what's going on in their mind. Now, this, you know, evolutionarily posed a very positive fact because it allowed us to better understand potential adversaries. You know, if you saw other large predators, if you saw other tribes, our capacity to empathize and make other things human and assign human-like thoughts to them facilitated our evolution and really facilitated our ability to, you know, grow and be social animals.
Speaking of WALL-E, that is one of the movies that my daughter could watch 1,000 times when she was little. I feel like it came out either when I had a new baby or I just like let her hit repeat on it. We saw it 1,000 times. So why is it that a kid can watch Frozen 1,000 times, WALL-E 1,000 times, and they are never sick of it and find new things every single time they watch? Whereas we can, I appreciate it, but I could walk away after one viewing.
This is really good. One element of the book that I did is I looked into eye track, essentially, because, you know, if you think about it, you know, movies affect us. This is a big crux of the book. We can see it in baby names. We can see it in dog breeds that we adopt. Dalmatians getting popular after we see the movie. We can see it in kids taking up archery after seeing The Hunger Games. We can see physical manifestations of you know, these things in our bodies and in our bloodstreams and in how we, you know, breathe during these films. We know that these things affect us. But the thing that's cool about it is that we have a very limited window of how of allowing it in, right? We have light and sound. Those are the two things. We have sound, the things that we hear in the film, and then we have light. We can actually put eye tracking goggles on and see where folks are watching a given film. We can see where they're looking. And the reason I bring this up is that adults, for a well-made film, for a directed film, for a film that you know, has intentionality behind it, are pretty good at kind of all looking at the same place. We're usually looking in the same, you know, 10 to 20% of the screen at a given time, and a capable director is making sure that we're looking at the right place at the right time. If you watch like security camera footage or something, which is not directed, you're just going to be looking all over. There's not going to be any unanimity in where folks are looking typically. But if you are looking at a directed film, you have learned over the course of your life where the director kind of wants you to look, what the important things to watch are, how to enjoy that. And so when you watch a movie, and particularly when you watch a good movie, you're going to kind of watch the same movie every time because your eyes are going to fall for the same tricks. The eyes are going to be guided as the director wants them to be guided, and you're going to look at where she wants you to look. Now, for a kid, that needs to be learned, much the same way that like any, you know, animal needs to learn how to hunt, right? We need to learn how to see and learn what's important. And so when a kid watches Frozen, they're kind of looking wherever they want, you know, especially the younger that you get, you are looking wherever you find interesting. So if Olaf is being silly in the background, even if there's fun stuff happening up front, but with Anna, you are going to maybe look at behind in the background, then maybe you're going to look at the trees, then maybe you're going to look at the snow. And so I would talk to folks who direct and work in kids' TV, and they would always be like, I'm always surprised whenever I see the comments, because it's always like, well, the shoelaces were tied in one scene, not the other. And no adult's going to be looking at the shoelaces, but the kids will watch things a million times and they'll look at a different place every time. And so they'll get a different experience. And over the course of it, they're going to learn how to actually watch things and how to watch as intended, as it were. But for the time being, they're very free form. They're very interesting. They can kind of watch the same thing a lot of times because it is genuinely a slightly different film every time for them.
Kids are amazing. Their brains are unbelievable. Yeah. I guess just getting back to grumpy old dad here. I mean, if they watch it too much, let's talk about screen time. Let's talk about kids and screen time. You live in a data-driven universe. What is the data saying about that?
This is a really good question. So I have good news and I have bad news.
Okay.
I'll start with the bad news, which is that You know, if you think about the kind of study that you would need to do to truly understand the impact of screen time on kids, it is incredibly hard and it has not been done yet. We have not had had enough data come in to have a very definitive answer, yes or no, on screen time. The good news is they're working on it. So they will have that in a couple of years. There's a study being done now that has a massive cohort of folks. What we do know is, and this is kind of my takeaway from the book, from the research and the folks that I talked to about it and all that, is that screen time inherently, it goes back to the violence thing, honestly. Screen time is not in and of itself good or bad. It is screen time instead of something that is good or bad. Mm. And so if it is screen time instead of screaming in the back of a car, probably fine. If it's screen time in lieu of being unhappy waiting for a plane, that's probably pretty fine. If it's screen time in lieu of going outside, that's not as fine, right? Because we know it's important to get sunlight for kids, especially for things like myopia down the line. It's important to run around, stay active in that. So if it's screen time at the expense of play dates, screen time at the expense of play, screen time at the expense of going outside, running around, it's probably not good. The worst thing, and the thing that was most correlated for, you know, any correlation that you have between screen time and academic performance, usually has this confounding thing in, which is if it's screen time at the expense of sleep, that is quite bad. Mm-hmm. That is, you know, because anytime that you're taking minutes or hours away from sleep, particularly for developing minds, that's going to be a problem for academics, for life, for development, and things like that. And the issue with screen time is that it can be very, very interesting at the time that we want folks to start going to sleep. And so it's essentially, you know, it's not good or bad. It's good or bad instead of what. And so, you know, sleep, very important. Try to not have screen time interfere with that too much, particularly any kind of screen time that will keep folks awake. Going outside, playing around, obviously you'd probably prefer that over watching stuff. But like in terms of just in general, you know, the other element of screen time is that particularly with a lot of kids' TV these days, at least the stuff that's made by, you know, you have the Fred Rogers Company, you have Sesame Street, you have a lot of people who have a lot of really interested and dedicated folks working to make good things. You know, it is really being very thoughtfully done. And particularly from some of the professional nonprofit apparatuses, particularly from the folks who deal in, you know, psychologists very early on, a lot of the stuff is productive. It can introduce kids to new experiences, new worlds, new cities, new people, new languages, new jobs. And so, you know, it's tough to kind of be down on it. You know, you do want to kind of take it responsibly, but I think at the end of the day, there is not like a screen time ledger that if you exceed, you will be a worse person than you were beforehand. It's oftentimes screen time coming at the expense of other kinds of recreation that are kind of fine. But it's more, is screen time taken away at something real important? Is screen time interfering with sleep? Is screen time interfering with play and outside? That's what you got to be careful about.
I will say anecdotally, with my first child, we were very like, no screens, books only, you know, yeah. Flashcards, that sort of thing. Whereas my second came along, I was busy and I, you know, here yeah. we go, Little Einsteins and Sesame Street. And then all of a sudden he's 2.5 and reading. I didn't work nearly as hard with this kid. And he was like, oh, no, Mom, you missed a page. At like age 3, he knew I was skipping paragraphs as I was reading. I know. So that's why I'm like, screen time can't all be bad, because I'm pretty sure my second learned how to read via Sesame Street.
With the reading thing, a lot of the book is about how when you consume things, how that affects you. The last chapter of the book, I break it out and I kind of flip it around. And I'm like, what does making stuff do for you? Mm-hmm. And the thing that I found consistently, there's two elements of this, is one, when it comes to reading, it's basically just a word count question. They could be reading, you know, The Scarlet Letter, or they could be reading, you know, fan fiction about their favorite character from their favorite TV show. And as long as they're consuming the words, it's kind of fine. And so being very omnivorous when it comes to reading, allowing kids to read what they want to read rather than necessarily what we want them to read, it just kind of comes down to you know, page count and word count. Even things like graphic novels, things like any way that folks can read is just going to be better for them inherently. I was a child of the 90s. Pizza Hut incentivizing me to read.
Giving you a personal pan pizza. Weirdly, hello. Yeah.
Yeah. I think we need to bring that back. I genuinely think so, because I think that if you can just plow through Goosebumps or Boxcar Kids or whatever have you, as long as you're interested in it, that's what makes readers lifelong, you know?
Yeah, we would need to bring back the entire dining area for Pizza Hut, the giant pitchers of Coca-Cola, and the flat screen Ms. Pac-Man as well, right? Because every Pizza Hut that I went to ever had all of those things.
Can I also also say it was very disappointing to me because I forget what the rewards were called, but you get a personal pan pizza from what I remember. Those were so small and I was a hungry girl.
Yeah.
So I was very, I know everybody else seemed full with their little personal pan pizza. I'm like, I need two. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Pizza Hut knew what they were doing. They knew you were going to want more food.
It was so delicious and I would try to nibble. Anyway.
I was like, I read Goblet of Fire. I should get a stuffed crust. I should. I deserve a stuffed crust, mommy.
Okay. I love having you on here, Walt, and I'm your time is valuable, so I don't want to take too much more.
Hey, the pleasure is honestly mine. This is a ton of fun. You guys are asking great questions.
What is the best way for our listeners to find more Walt Hickey?
Oh gosh, thank you for asking that. If they like this stuff, you know, the book is out. It's available wherever books are sold. It's called You Are What You Watch. I have a newsletter that comes out every morning all about numbers in the news. I've been doing it for a past, I started it just after I left 538 a few years ago when I was doing their daily morning newsletter. It's called Numlock, like the key on the keyboard. They can find that at numlock.com if they're interested in fun, cool facts about the world. You know, I'm on various different social media things, and I did just take a job. I'm also by day the executive editor of Sherwood News, which is a cool new business news site that folks should check out if they're down. But yeah, I mean, pick up the book, check out the newsletter. That's the best way to get a hold of me. You know, if folks enjoy it, definitely reach out. I love talking to folks about, you know, what their feelings are about the book and hearing about what movies mattered to people. It's always such a cool way to kind of start a conversation. But yeah, those are the best way to get a hold of me.
Well, thank you so much. This was so much fun.
Thank you for having me. This is a ton of fun. You guys are great.
That was so much fun to talk to Walt Hickey. And, you know, now, like he was saying, now that we're just aware of what media does to our body, we could pay attention to it and kind of curate our experiences. I'm going to be paying more attention.
And also, I felt like I went down memory lane a little bit. Like he started talking about Jurassic Park. We even talked about it beforehand. There's so many of those 90s movies that really kind of are stuck in our brains.
Classics. Okay. Special fun and game segment, you guys. Our very favorite and your very favorite producer, Emery Tapke's here. We're doing some 90s movie trivia ? Is that what you have planned for us today?
Yes, we are doing 90s movie and TV trivia.
Okay, I want to put an asterisk next to my performance because I am very competitive. I hate to lose, but also during the 90s, I was very busy and didn't have access to a VCR. So I'm just saying.
Okay, hang on. You can't handicap yourself.
I'm starting plus three. Okay,
I was also busy in the 90s being a student at college and working very hard in my first job.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Take it away, Andrew.
Well, not me. I was just chilling at my parents' house. So. <That's it. laughs> No, why don't we do this? Let's have it be, you guys can work as a team.
Okay.
Do you guys... Give me a trivia team name.
Wait,
are you doing this just because I was being grumpy? We can go back and forth. We can do it. We can do it. And she doesn't want to cause a fight. No, we're fine. We can compete. I also win. It's fine.
Okay, who wants to take the first question? I'm going to give it to Kim. How about that?
Okay, yay. Hopefully it's an easy one.
Okay, Kim, number one. What was the first animated featured film to be nominated for a Best Picture at the Oscars?
Oh, was it the Fievel one, like the mouse one, like he's going home, like Fievel coming to, like the mouse goes to America?
I did love that movie. I burnt out like a VHS tape on that movie.
All right, so it's not Fievel going.
But it's not that movie. And it honestly, I'll give you a little hint. It's the only one that's ever been nominated for Best Picture.
Yep.
Toy Story.
You are so close. It is in the Disney family.
Oh, they're all in the Disney family. I don't know. What is it, Penn?
It's a Pixar movie, right? Wasn't it Inside Out?
No, in the 90s.
It's not.
Oh, it was in the 90s?
Yep.
Okay, tell us.
Oh, wait. Was it a Pixar movie?
Yes.
It was like one of the first picks. Oh. Was it a Lion King?
Good guess, but no.
Okay.
Let's move on. What do we got?
Wally. Yeah, I don't know.
It was Disney's Beauty and the Beast.
Oh.
Really?
Really?
Okay.
It was. So Beauty and the Beast was the only animated feature film nominated for Best Picture before the category of Best Animated Feature was created.
Got
so
it.
They basically had to create that category. But it did lose Best Picture in 1992 to Silence of the Lambs.
Oh, very different vibe.
Can you imagine, like, look, Beauty and the Beast was great, but can you imagine, like, Anthony Hopkins and Jodie Foster watching, like, these cartoon people walk up and take the Oscar away from them?
And Beauty and the Beast, by the way, fun karaoke soundtrack. Like,
very fun.
Very fun. The Belle's, like, welcome song, the Bonjour song.
You can play all the parts.
You can play all the parts on stage as one person, and it's a hit.
We've seen it done expertly.
Okay, go for it.
I can't wait. This is our next team bonding activity. Okay, number two for Penn. Out of the top 10 highest grossing films of the 1990s, one actor starred in three of them. So 30% of them. Who is that actor?
So three highest grossing films in 1995. There weren't a ton of Star Wars there. There were some big, like Indiana Jones, Air Force One. So my instinct, I would start by saying Harrison Ford, but I'm not sure. The other person I'm thinking of is Bruce Willis because of Armageddon and Die Hard.
That's a very good guess.
But I don't think it's either of them. Because
this is how he plays Trivial Pursuit, by the way.
Because I'm reading you. I'm reading Anne-Marie's face.
He plays Trivial Pursuit.
I love how he's
like
just narrating everything that's going on in his brain. I'll give you a small hint. Two of the films are part of a franchise, and you already have mentioned it earlier.
Okay. Well, gosh, I said Star Wars, but that wasn't in the 90s. I said Indiana.
Not earlier just now, but like earlier in our conversation.
Tom Hanks was in Toy Story, and he was in... But have I said Tom Hanks yet? No. I don't like being wrong about things. Did I say Tom Hanks out loud or was that just in my brain?
He plays Trivial Pursuit with his mouth.
Jeff Goldblum was in Independence Day. He was in Jurassic Park and he was in Lost World.
Wow.
You are right.
Did I get it?
Jeff Goldblum.
Woo!
Jurassic Park 93,
I remember
Lost
that.
World 97, Independence Day 96.
I remember thinking that dude was in some movies.
All three of those films grossed together over $2.5 billion with a B.
And you know, $2.5 billion went a lot farther back then. JK.
Really did.
It's still a lot of money.
Might as well have been a quadrillion, I mean.
That's just an imaginary amount of money. Good job, babe.
I just remember thinking, like, Jeff Goldblum was in, like, one movie before then, and then all of a sudden, in, like, 4 years, he just blew up.
I think I just would have said Meg Ryan, because I feel like Meg Ryan was also in everything.
Oh, she was in. And Tom Hanks is a good guest, too. Yeah. And actually, Bruce Willis and Will Smith also. Will Smith was in Men in Black and Independence Day.
Yep.
Kim, number three. Can you name all seven members of the first cast of MTV's The Real World?
No. I know.
Can you name any members?
There was that Kit or something, because I feel like she's still...
Kit Carson?
Or Kit or Kat, because I feel like she's still on TV.
With the
Am
situation?
I making that up? And there was a boy that she was into. So here's what you need to know about me. I am such a bad judge and should never be in an executive role at any... sort of entertainment firm, because I remember being in our CBS newsroom when Survivor first aired. I'm like, who would watch that show? That sounds awful. And yet it's still CBS's number one hit. So I saw that show being aired. I'm like, that's so stupid. And I think it's still airing. So I have nothing. That's a long way of saying my finger is far from the pulse of what America watches. And I have no idea.
Wait, can you name all seven, Anne-Marie?
No, in fact, the first one I remember is The Real World Seattle, so I don't even remember this cast.
Yeah. Was there a Kit or a Cat or something like that?
There was a Kevin, so I'll tell you there's definitely Andre.
She's so nice. There was a Kevin.
There
I'll give
was
you points
a Steve.
For, I'll give you points for Kevin. It was close.
Oh, gosh, you got it. So close.
So there. Close.
Becky, Andre, Heather, Julie, Norman, Eric, and Kevin.
I
would have gotten zero of those.
Yeah,
you're getting the tough ones. Like, these are all pretty tough, Anne-Marie.
The Real World was inspired by the 1973 PBS documentary series called An American Family, and it focused on the lives of a group of strangers who auditioned to live together for several months while cameras recorded them. So actually, this idea was like birthed in the 70s, and even before then, Candid Camera was like in the, you know, even 50s or even before that time. So reality TV has been around for a minute, everybody who thinks it's new. All right, Penn, hopefully this is not a super big softball, but it might be. What was the most watched TV episode of the 90s?
When did The Sopranos finish up?
We were, I think that's 2000s.
Okay.
I could be wrong, though.
I'm going to go with the Seinfeld finale.
The answer is the Cheers finale.
Shucks,
in 1993.
You're right. You're right. Darn it. That's a, God darn it. Gosh, darn it.
Oh, darn it.
That was a good one, too. Okay. Yep. That's an X for me. Okay. Have any of
According to NBC, the final episode of Cheers was watched by 93 million viewers, which was 40% of the population at the time.
Wow.
You just don't get that many people watching anything right now.
Right.
Besides a Mr. Right. Beast video on YouTube.
Besides Caitlin Clark.
Besides Caitlin Clark. Nobody is watching any content. I think people are thrilled. I think TV networks are thrilled right now with 3 million people watching.
Yeah.
Kim, the movie Clueless, do you know what novel it was loosely based off of?
I do.
Do you want to phone a friend that's sitting next to you?
Okay, Penn, what is it?
Oh, wait, sorry. I don't know.
You thought it was 10 Things I Hate About You.
I thought
it was Taming of the Shrew.
I thought it was an autobiography, not a novel. So I'm sorry. Go ahead. I thought Cher's autobiography or something.
No, I got nothing.
Okay. Clueless was loosely based off of the novel Emma by Jane Austen.
Really?
Cher is a representation of the main character, Emma Woodhouse. She's spunky, carefree, entitled, and a matchmaker. And the plots and the characters were all inspired by the book.
I did not know that. See, there are no new ideas. There are no new ideas is what we get back to.
And if there are new ideas, we're getting them all wrong.
We're getting them all wrong.
Yeah. Okay, we're going to get one of these right.
Okay.
Penn,
yes.
What TV show's creator had a rule that its characters could not learn lessons or hug at the end of episodes?
Oh, that's Larry David, 100%. because the last episode of Seinfeld, we were just talking about this. They were like, no hugs, no tears. And I think they broke the rule in the last episode.
Yeah, he said, no hugging, no learning. He wanted to depict life as accurately and humorously as possible. And then to quote someone on the internet, Luke Baker, I found, who is a writer, he said, you come for the shenanigans and you stay for the shenanigans and you're not upset when you don't have moral closure.
Oh,
so
interesting.
The characters don't grow, they don't learn, but you know what to expect from them every time.
Larry David.
I feel like a lot of people have taken that philosophy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Larry David's a genius and his stuff is so funny. And I loved Seinfeld. I could never get hooked on Curb Your Enthusiasm for the same reason that you couldn't.
It's too uncomfortable.
Yeah.
I just don't love,
I love it.
I don't love awkward comedy. And so it was too uncomfortable. They're geniuses, obviously. They're doing great.
Honestly, like Seinfeld was the same way, but they had a laugh track, which gave me permission to like realize that this is not real. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. All right. Number 7, Kim, second time around was the theme song for what TV series?
Sing it for me.
Second time around.
Amory, can you please sing that for us?
And you need to make sure I know all the words. I might just hum it.
Yep.
Will there ever be a second time around? Booty. Whoa.
Do you know this?
Nope.
Second time around. What's a not? Is it who's the boss?
Day by day.
Oh, day by day.
No.
Oh, is it Who's
the
Boss?
The song.
No. I got nothing. I'm really bad at this. Nothing. I have nothing.
Step by step.
Step by step. That's
step
it.
Step by step.
Okay, and I found this fascinating. There's a guy named Jesse Frederick, and he wrote and performed all the themes to the ABC TGIF television shows, Perfect Strangers, Full House, Family Matters, and Step by Step.
I did know there was one guy who did a bunch of them.
What a legend.
I think that Penn was born a tiny too late, because I think that is where we could have seen him be a true superhero, is in writing theme songs for 90s sitcoms. I feel like you would have been so good at that.
There were some good ones.
Yeah. And I just feel like you would be so good at that. And then you could just retire.
Maybe they'll come back to a time where they're like, you know, we do need a minute of opening credits. Because nobody does that anymore.
Nobody does it anymore.
You know, everything circles back, Penn, so you never know.
That's true.
And if anybody's listening and needs a jingle for a sitcom, you know who to call. Okay, next question.
Okay, Penn, what character from Beavis and Butthead was given their own show?
Hank Hill. Mr. Anderson.
No.
It wasn't Hank Over the Hill. So he wasn't in Beavis and Butthead? Are you sure?
Yes.
Okay, so the only other ones I can think of...
was not a man.
Darla.
Daria.
Daria. Sorry, Daria. Okay.
Created as a smart female character on Beavis and Butthead.
That's
to
right.
Put them in her place. She went through different outfits, different voices, but eventually... she developed a very iconic style and tone, and she got her own show in 1997.
Go Daria.
She's actually number 41 on the top 50 greatest cartoon characters of all time, wow, according to TV Guide.
Did you guys see the SNL skit a couple of weeks ago where there was
yeah, they were Beavis and Butthead.
It was a debate, and there were people who clearly looked like Beavis and Butthead in the debate audience.
Yes. Anyway,
it was so wonderfully stupid.
People were saying it's one of like the best breaks of all time, yeah, with the cast cracking up.
Yeah, I am an outlier. Maybe I love it when they break. I'm like, can we all just laugh?
Me too.
I love it.
Me too. Except I got a little tired of Jimmy Fallon doing it. Like I wanted.
Yeah, he needed to keep it together.
Like seriously, dude, you're a professional. Like the first one was great, and then I'm like, come on, man. Sorry.
Kim, number 9. Who played the unsinkable Molly Brown in Titanic?
Oh, is that Kathy Bates?
Yes!
I got one.
Yay!
I got one. Hot take. I think Titanic wasn't as everybody left the theater crying. And I didn't find it so sad because I thought Rose was a little selfish.
You were the first one on the, there's plenty of room on that door.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah. I mean, my girlfriends are like, you have to go see this. You're going to cry your eyes out. Let's all go together. And I was like, I think she's really selfish. She just watched him fall. That's really selfish. Yeah.
I cried, but I was in middle school and I don't think I'd ever seen anything like sad before. So
yeah,
I saw it at the movie theater in the mall.
I thought it was great. I liked the science of it. I liked the part where they kept going back and like, I liked those scenes that she was in because they had like the CAD designs of what happened to the ship. And then, you know, we got to see what it really looked like. So I loved that part of it.
Yeah.
Did you know that Reba McEntire was originally offered the role of the unsinkable Molly Brown, but she had to drop out when the production was delayed and she had to go on tour?
Aww.
And so they like their second choice was an Oscar winner. That's
Kathy Bates. I know. I was like, I would have put Kathy Bates in. Like, Kathy Bates is fabulous in everything she's
in.
Yeah,
she had just gotten off of Misery for that movie. Like, Misery was freaking amazing.
I also love Reba. So who knows? Yeah. Maybe Reba would have been amazing too.
Also, want to point out that I forget which Britney Spears song, because you guys know I love my Britney Spears. The guy hands her a necklace. She's like, oh, the necklace. I thought the old lady threw it in the ocean at the end. He's like, oh, baby, I went down and got it for you. What song was that?
Isn't it Oops, I Did It Again?
I don't know. Do you remember? Do you know that?
Is that in Lucky?
No, it's Lucky. It's like, isn't she lucky?
Look it up. I think it's Oops, I Did It Again.
I think we should play. No. We should play.
I think it's Lucky.
I think it's Lucky, but I feel like at this point, we need to insert that.
I don't think it's Lucky.
It is, honey.
Okay. Kim's about to be really disappointed. It's
Spears,
not Lucky.
No, I think she's right, actually.
Maybe it is.
I think you're right, though.
And I'm really embarrassed that I know this.
Oh, it might be Oops, I Did It Again.
Oh!
Okay, hold on.
This is quite the upset.
Okay. Penn is right. It is.
Well, baby, I went down and got it for you.
Oh, you shouldn't have.
Oops, I did it again.
Yep.
Okay, so Penn was right. It was Oops, I Did It Again. The beauty of what pop culture has done is Titanic takes place on an ocean. This music video happened in space. So this man left the moon,
mm-hmm,
went down to the bottom of the ocean,
yep,
got the necklace.
I mean, there's a lot of plot holes.
And handed it to Britney Spears.
He's not wearing a helmet.
That's not love. I don't know what it is, guys.
Yeah. Okay, moving on.
Penn.
Yes.
In the movie Speed, why was Annie, Sandra Bullock's character's driver's license suspended?
I think it was reckless driving or speeding. Speeding, I think, was a specific term.
She was speeding.
Yeah. Fun fact.
Ding, ding, ding. You got that correct.
Fun fact. Sandra Bullock, I think, has some sort of upbringing in or around North Carolina. I think we try to claim her.
No.
Bullock attended East Carolina University in Greenville.
That could be true. I will tell you, in preparation for the movie Speed, she learned to drive a bus and she passed on her first try. So there's nothing that woman can't do.
Well, thank you very much for this walk down memory lane and any opportunity to play Britney Spears.
Amory, thank you. Those were some challenging questions.
They were.
I do have a bonus. Do you want one more bonus?
Yes, yeah. Bonus.
We'll do this together as a team.
This might be it. Well, I don't want to typecast. I'm thinking it might be a Penn bonus, but maybe Kim knows it.
Okay.
Do you know what city and state the movie Tommy Boy was set in?
It was it's Sandusky, Ohio.
Yes.
Yes.
The roller coaster capital of the world.
Tommy After 7 years, Tommy barely graduates from Marquette, and he returns to his hometown of Sandusky, Ohio.
Where he works for Callahan Automotive in their new brake pad division.
I think that is one of the most quoted movies by me, because anytime I hurt myself, I go, not so much like here or here, but right here. Like when he gets hit in the face with the 4x4.
Bob, I lost my virginity to your daughter, for God's sake.
Sorry.
I have
Bill, you were there.
You have family.
I have family in Sandusky, and I introduced someone over the weekend to a family member of mine, and someone said, oh, like Tommy Boy, and I had forgotten that that was even in the movie, so I fact-checked it and put it in the trivia today.
I love it. That was such a good movie. Well, thank you very much, Anne-Marie Tapke, for joining us and providing a trivia break for us all. As we wrap up the podcast, first of all, thank you for listening. Share this podcast if you think that somebody you know might be interested in all the fun facts.
Oh, and Anne-Marie, so when you listen to this, because you're also a wonderful producer of this podcast, what did we forget? And do you just want to do it for us on this one?
Oh, like do your closing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Hey, listeners. Next week, Penn and Kim are going to have a very special preview of their ADHD is Awesome audiobook. So stay tuned for that. Very exciting. The book comes out 1 week from today, if you're listening on the day this airs. And we'll see you then.
Yay!
See, you did that way better than we would have.
Yeah. Thank you, Anne-Marie. And thank you, everybody who's listening. We love you.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.